Get informed no matter where you are or what you're doing. Subscribe to Bloomberg News now and get news when you want it on your schedule.
Big tech dominating our headlines.
Another win for Donald Trump.
A key inflation report.
These are short audio reports, 5 minutes or less, that bring you the latest headlines with context 24 hours a day. Stay on top of the latest news from around the world. Get it on your smartphone. Subscribe to Bloomberg News now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen.
Spain could become the first country to ban fossil fuel advertising.
These ads will portray companies like ExxonMobil or Shell as clean energy companies or as companies that are leading the way in the fight against climate change.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Today, how ad campaigns spread disinformation and a global push to fix that. Also, Israel's concerning new approach to preventing nuclear armament in Iran.
You can't just bomb facilities or stockpiles. You actually have to kill the scientists.
Plus, Haitians mourn the loss of an iconic hotel. And flag football players get ready for the 2028 Olympics.
It's strategy, it's athleticism, it all comes to play here in flag football.
That's all ahead today here on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for joining us this Tuesday. We begin in the capital of Haiti, Port-au-Prince, where an iconic landmark, the Hotel Olofsson, has burned to the ground. It was set ablaze by gangs over the weekend. The 19th century mansion was a well-known hub for Western journalists and celebrities, as well as local artists, like Haitian-American singer Riva Precile, who lived in the hotel as a child. It's where she learned to sing and dance. When she learned that the Olofsson had burned down, she told the Associated Press, so much culture and expression was birthed there.
It survived coups, dictatorships, even the massive earthquake that killed hundreds of thousands of people and turned much of the Haitian capital to rubble in 2010. Harold Isaac is a reporter based in Haiti. He previously visited the hotel and told us what its grand spires and intricate details meant to Haitians.
The gingerbread style that the Hotel Olofsson had is really iconic of the heydays, really, of the wooden architecture here in Haiti. And this house just so happens that it was also a presidential house at some point, and it also eventually became a U.S. Marine Corps hospital during the occupation. So it had a lot of history within its walls. So this is really a reflection of a spirit, you know, that this country had back then. And this is perhaps what's most devastating.
How was this hotel seen by Haitians in recent years? It did stand despite the country really descending into violence. Was it something that came to represent, you know, class divide and income disparity in Haiti?
Well, it's more complicated than that. I mean, the location itself had been vacated for all matters and purposes in the last year.
Right.
As gangs were waging really very strong assaults against the area, especially Carrefour Feuil and Paco. And it's as part of clashes between police forces and the gangs over the weekend that the fire happened. And honestly, it was a very sad and perhaps inevitable conclusion to, you know, to a otherwise, you know, epic life of this building.
Mm.
And in a weird way, the problem is the attention that the building is getting.
Mm-hmm.
While, you know, half of the 11 million people population here in Haiti is facing famine like hunger. And while about a million people have been displaced by gang violence over the last few years, and you have a wave of Haitian migration due to this whole crisis. And while there is a massive political mayhem right now with no end in sight, the situation is very, very complicated in Haiti. And this is just an illustration of how bad it gotten.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this building is getting so much attention because it feels to an outsider, at least, to be quite symbolic. I mean, this is the hotel, as we've talked about, that survived periods of extreme upheaval in the past, the devastating earthquake back in 2010. Does this seem symbolic to you? Does this say anything to you about this particular moment in Haiti?
Well, personally speaking, honestly, it made the same type of shock as when I saw in 2010 the National Palace collapsed. And I remember, you know, I was there about 2 years ago, and essentially we could hear shooting not too far from there. So you could hear the violence closing in, and now 90% of the capital is under some form of gang control. You know, so it goes to show you how fragile the situation has been. And honestly, people tend to say Haiti's a failed country. But honestly, from the perspective of folks here, Haiti is a country that has been failed.
That has been failed by its leadership, by outside forces?
By both local leadership and international community. I mean, honestly, it creates this really kind of lackluster and this sluggishness, you know, that I could say, that is affecting the daily life of everybody, you know, because being here is really an act of resistance for most folks I know. And I think what makes it worse is that you don't feel any hope that things may turn around in the foreseeable future.
You know, we could debate whether it's appropriate or not to spend so much time talking about a building when, as you have mentioned, there are so many people suffering in Haiti. But this is a thing that happens. We've seen in other conflicts or disasters that people outside of the affected region sometimes have this deep reaction when art or antiquities or historic buildings are damaged. Why do you think that is, that these inanimate objects really get people's attention?
Well, it's because perhaps this is what connects people to an idea. That's what connects people to a spirit of a country. But when it's gone, and you know that it's gone, and it's gone in what circumstances? It wasn't an accident. It wasn't a storm. You know, it wasn't thunder. It was, you know, human-based, human-made violence. And this is sadly what we're seeing today.
Harold Isaac joined us for that discussion earlier today. He's a reporter in Haiti. We'll have photos of the Hotel Olofsson and other Haitian architecture up online later today. Check those out at theworld.org.
Turning our attention now to the Middle East, where Yemen's Houthi rebels have attacked two ships in the Red Sea in recent days. On Sunday, they struck a Greek-owned merchant ship with a combination of drones, missiles, and small arms fire that caused the vessel to take on water, forcing the crew of 22 to abandon ship.
A Houthi military spokesman claimed responsibility for the attack in a video. The group said the ship belonged to a company that, quote, violated the ban on entry to the ports of occupied Palestine. According to the Houthis, that made the ship a legitimate military target. The European Commission released a statement today condemning the attack, calling it a serious escalation that jeopardizes peace and stability throughout the region and risks environmental harm.
Yesterday, another Greek-owned ship was attacked, killing three mariners and wounding two more. Yemen's government in exile, along with EU forces, have blamed the Houthis for that attack, although the rebel group has not claimed responsibility.
These attacks follow a truce announced by President Trump back in May. The U.S. agreed to stop its military campaign against the Houthis in exchange for an end to Houthi attacks on merchant ships. These latest ones are the first Houthi attacks on Red Sea shipping since December. For spectators, the Summer Olympics in Los Angeles isn't even really on the radar yet. It is still 3 years away, but that is not that long for athletes who hope to compete in the Games. The World's Bianca Hillier gives us a look at how training is going for competitors in one sport that's making its Olympic debut in 2028.
If you only know flag football as a backyard or gym class activity, let me fill you in. These days, flag football is big.
It's strategy, it's athleticism, it all comes to play here in flag football.
According to the NFL, which has been a key investor in the sport's growth, more than 20 million people in over 100 countries play the game. Many are young kids and amateurs, but a lot of them are professionals.
Scrambles right, throws up the sideline. It is complete. Good for a first down.
On the international stage, countries such as Austria, Denmark, Mexico, and Panama consistently do well at world championships. The reigning champion, though, is Team USA, on the women's and men's sides.
Here's Doucette with his reply. Throwing deep, throwing complete. Making it look easy.
Darryl Doucette has been the quarterback on the U.S. men's team since 2020. He's been called the best flag football player in the world and says he never would have imagined the sport he loves to be in the Olympics.
Now that it's here, I'm just grateful to be able to see it happen.
You may think a player like Doucette would essentially walk on to an Olympic team, but in reality, he's going to have major competition. A few global rugby players have said they may give it a go. Then there's the bigger threat. The NFL. Here's Commissioner Roger Goodell in May.
We're excited to announce today that the NFL owners unanimously passed a resolution giving every NFL player an opportunity to play in the Olympics in 2028 in Los Angeles.
NFL players can now become Olympians. Many fans are thrilled to be able to cheer on their favorite players on sport's biggest stage. And a few of the league's players themselves have said they're interested, like Minnesota Vikings wide receiver Justin Jefferson.
You know, just to think about the chances of playing in the Olympics and getting a gold medal is a dream.
The NFL has made it clear that they see flag football's inclusion in the Olympics as a big win for tackle football players. In a promotional video, Philadelphia Eagles quarterback Jalen Hurts throws a football to light up the Olympic torch.
It's our turn.
It's our turn, he says. There's no doubt that an athlete like Hurts has skills that could make him an incredible, world-class flag footballer. But some players who have dedicated their lives to flag football say the NFL players shouldn't just assume they'll make the team. Here's Darryl Doucette again.
We've been training, and we have to try out every year to make this national team. It's never given to us. And when it came to Olympics, I didn't want it to be given to anybody else either.
Doucette is clear that he doesn't want an us versus them narrative. He even thinks NFL players could bring much needed attention to his sport. But flag football is a different game, and Doucette thinks in general people are underestimating flag footballers around the world.
As far as our hips and dipping, the speed, the elusiveness, it's just different. It's a fast-paced game, and I've never shied away from competition. I plan on hopefully making that team. And I hope my teammates are able to make it as well. Hey, let the best man win and we go win the gold medal.
Another country seeing major investments in flag football is Nigeria. Last month, the country's men's and women's teams both won gold at Africa's inaugural flag football championships. Many of the athletes crucial in those wins play in a professional league called Showtime Flag.
Hands it to Bimbi, makes the roar! Touchdown!
Lagos-based Showtime Flag started up in 2023. Bibi Shashure coaches one of its top teams, the Warriors. He says the growth of the game makes sense because it's all the fun of regular or tackle football without the danger.
Is it really that exciting to sort of hit each other mercilessly the way tackle football does, you know?
Showtime Flag teams are also co-ed, with men and women on the field at the same time. Shashura says including women has given the league a huge boost in popularity. He also thinks the co-ed experience will give the Nigerian women a leg up when it comes to the Olympics.
I think the girls have a really good chance to medal. I know U.S. and Mexico are formidable opponents, but I think the Nigerian girls team is going to, you know, be a surprising factor in the Olympic Games.
Even if that doesn't happen, Showtime Flag founder Aziz Amida says that's okay, because for them, the Olympics is not the main goal.
Beyond 2028, there needs to be a sport. And what we focus on is to say Olympics is important, but if there's a grassroots sport, you don't need to worry about that destination. You just need to keep playing. In the next 50 years, 30 years, we're here.
Only six countries will earn a coveted spot at the LA Games for a chance to become the first ever Olympic champions in the sport. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. It's come to be known as the 12-day war, the recent attacks launched by Israel against Iran. In that time, Israel killed at least 14 scientists who worked on Iran's nuclear program. It's a move that aligns with Israel's longstanding goal of destroying the country's nuclear capabilities. The thinking goes, if you eliminate the brains behind the program, you set it back at least a couple of years. But this attack was unprecedented in scope, and as the world's Shirin Jafari reports, it's also raised serious questions about ethics and legality.
The Israeli military dubbed it Operation Narnia, after the fantasy novels by the British author C.S. Lewis. Just before dawn on June 13th, explosions ripped through the homes of nine scientists in Iran, killing them all simultaneously. This video posted online of the aftermath at one of the sites showed people in shock and confused. A large fire lights up the pile of rubble that used to be a home. In the roughly two-week war, Israel killed at least 14 scientists, according to reports. Israel's ambassador to France, Joshua Zarqa, defended the operation in an interview with the Associated Press.
Physicists and engineers and nuclear engineers that were not because of the fact that they knew physics, but because of the fact that they were personally involved in the creation and the prefabrication and the production of a nuclear weapon.
Iran doesn't have a nuclear weapons program. What it has so far is civilian, according to the UN body that monitors its activities. The Israelis, however, say they worry Iran could turn this program into weapons, and that's why it should be destroyed. Since 2010, about 20 Iranian scientists who worked on the program have been killed in a variety of ways, by poison, in car bombs, and drive-by shootings. In 2021, Iran's top nuclear scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, was killed in Tehran by a remote-controlled machine gun. State TV showed his black Nissan riddled with bullets. In the past, Israel didn't openly claim responsibility for these killings, but it also didn't deny being behind them. In the days following the recent attacks, funerals for the scientists took place in Tehran. Crowds gathered around their coffins draped in the Iranian flag. One scientist, Mohammad Reza Siddiqi Saber, was killed along with 12 members of his family. The victims included teenagers and children as young as 6 years old. Another scientist, Mohammad Mehdi Tehranchi, was killed at his home along with his wife. News reports said seven of his neighbors were also killed.
The Israelis are trying to make sure that Iran simply cannot reconstitute any type of a nuclear program. And to do so, you can't just bomb facilities or stockpiles. You actually have to kill the scientists.
Tirita Parsi is the executive vice president of the Quincy Institute. He has long advocated for diplomacy with Iran instead of military action.
What I think is most shocking about what they have done beyond the complete disregard for civilian life is the manner in which the killing of scientists, university professors, their children, their wives, their neighbors has been completely normalized.
Parsi says these assassinations have raised anger among Iranians in general, who say they can become collateral damage at any time. Israel's plans to kill Iranian scientists have long been in the works. In a 2018 Israeli documentary, former Prime Minister Ehud Barak says Israel could not sit around and watch Iran's nuclear program expand. So when I became defense minister, he says, it became clear to me that we have to fight the program with all our force. But critics say these killings raise legal and moral questions.
Scientists who are working on even a nuclear weapons program are not legitimate targets for assassination.
Mary Ellen O'Connell is an expert on international law at the University of Notre Dame. She says under international law, everyone is considered a civilian when not involved in direct fighting.
Armed conflict hostilities are an intense exchange of organized armed fighting that lasts at least a day, if not longer.
These scientists were not directly involved in fighting with Israel, she says. Governments like the U.S. loosened and expanded their interpretation of the law regarding targeting killings after 9/11, O'Connell adds. But this case is different.
What the U.S., the U.K., the one time, and a few other countries have done has never reached to people clearly in a civilian status, namely scientists. This is a uniquely Israeli practice.
Besides the legal and moral concerns, there are also practical ones. Gary Seymour advised Presidents Clinton and Obama on nuclear arms control.
If we decide that we can assassinate people that are working for their government, then it makes it very difficult for us to object if other governments decide to assassinate our officials who are working for the government.
Seymour was speaking there in that 2018 documentary. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has made the argument that Iran was close to weaponizing its nuclear program and that he had to act fast. The American intelligence community disputes that. In an interview with ABC News on June 16th, Netanyahu mentioned the targeting of nuclear scientists.
We've targeted their top nuclear scientists. It's basically Hitler's nuclear team. You know, we got them.
Netanyahu has presented Israel's war against Iran's nuclear program as one that benefits the whole world. He's made destroying this program his mission since the 1990s. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
The limits on how many countries can have nuclear weapons goes back to 1970 when the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty went into effect.
The first milestone, reducing the danger of nuclear war and which led to lasting peace among nations.
We'll hear how that treaty is holding up on tomorrow's show.
And now a quick look at a few stories we've got our eyes on. The first ever malaria medicine designed for infants and small babies was approved today in Switzerland. Malaria kills hundreds of thousands of people each year, mostly in Africa. The drug company Novartis said the medicine will be available on a largely not-for-profit basis in countries where malaria is endemic.
The International Criminal Court in The Hague issued arrest warrants today for two leaders of the Taliban. The warrants accuse the Taliban's supreme leader and the head of Afghanistan's Supreme Court of persecuting women and girls. Since returning to power in Afghanistan 4 years ago, the Taliban have banned women from public places and stopped girls from attending school after sixth grade.
And in Yerevan, Armenia, a brawl broke out today in parliament after opposition lawmaker Artur Sargsyan said Armenia had become a bastion of dictatorship. He also called for President Nikol Pashinyan to be ousted. As Sargsyan tried to leave the chamber, other lawmakers stopped him and security guards joined the fray. Armenia's investigative committee has accused the lawmaker and 15 others of plotting to overthrow the government. President Pashinyan's government says the opposition is trying to engineer a coup.
Get more news and stories on our website, theworld.org, and on our YouTube channel.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Today in Haiti, people are reeling from the loss of the iconic Hotel Olofsson in Port-au-Prince that burned to the ground over the weekend. It was set on fire by gangs in the Haitian capital. The famous gathering place for Western journalists and celebrities had a lot of cachet. Earlier in the show, we heard from journalist Harold Isaac in Haiti, who put the loss of a building in context with the crisis facing people in Haiti.
Well, it's more complicated than that. Honestly, it was a very sad and perhaps inevitable conclusion to, you know, to a otherwise, you know, epic life of this building. Mm. And in a weird way, the problem is the attention that the building is getting, while, you know, half of the 11 million people population here in Haiti is facing famine-like hunger, and while about a million people have been displaced by gang violence over the last few years, and you have a wave of Haitian migration due to this whole crisis, and while there is a massive political mayhem right now with no end in sight, the situation is very, very complicated in Haiti. And this is just an illustration of how bad it gotten.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this building is getting so much attention because it feels to an outsider, at least, to be quite symbolic. I mean, this is the hotel that survived periods of extreme upheaval in the past, the devastating earthquake back in 2010. Does this seem symbolic to you? Does this say anything to you about this particular moment in Haiti?
Well, personally speaking, honestly, it made the same type of shock as when I saw in 2010 the National Palace collapse. It goes to show you how fragile the situation has been. And honestly, people tend to say Haiti's a failed country. But honestly, from the perspective of folks here, Haiti is a country that has been failed.
Journalist Harold Isaac on the loss of Hotel Olofsson in Port-au-Prince.
We'll keep following the news in Haiti as it unfolds. If you're a TV watcher, you know that commercials are just part of the deal and hard to avoid, like this one for a Ford pickup.
The 2025 F-150 is a part of Ford F-Series, the best-selling truck lineup.
In Spain, ads like these could become a thing of the past because the product in question burns gas. And if a proposed law goes into effect, it will ban advertising for fossil fuels and products that use them. As part of our Big Fix series about solutions to climate change, the world's Jerry Haddon reports from Barcelona.
This is an ad from Spanish car maker Seat.
Corre, corre, caballito. Trota por la carretera.
Run, run, little horse, sings a voice. Run down the road. On screen, you see kids running on the beach and through green fields. It all feels, well, somehow environmentally friendly. Under Spain's proposed consumer protection law, ads like this would go dark.
A menudo se comenta que la palabra sostenible es cada vez más manoseada.
Recently, Spain's Minister for Social Rights, Pablo Bistundi, said that the concept of sustainability is too often misused by companies to greenwash their image. We need to take the term seriously, he said, as we face our global crisis of climate change. The only car ads the law would allow would be for electric vehicles or hybrids, like the one seen in this ad, also from Seat. As for gas, no more ads either, unless the fuel contains at least 29% of an eco-friendly additive, like, say, ethanol. Airlines would see their advertising wings clipped too. Hawking flights shorter than 2.5 hours would be outlawed if there's alternative public transportation. The common denominator bad guy here is, of course, petroleum. The government wants to treat it like tobacco. It's bad for your health and the environment, so no more ads for it. The government hopes the ban will prompt fossil fuel industries to speed up their transition to greener alternatives. But will it work? I decide to check in with a guy who knows fossil fuels well, whose hands are stained with grease and motor oil. Our local mechanic, Jordi. With this proposal, everyone gets to look good, Jordi scoffs. But it's foolishness. It's pure propaganda, he says, window dressing. It's the government greenwashing itself, Jordi says, because everyone knows people will keep buying gasoline. Unless traditional cars are banned outright or electric vehicles become cheap and practical enough to take over the market. These days, he says, the real problem is that everything is disposable. Cars don't last. You used to buy a car and it would last your whole life. Now you use something till it breaks down, then you just toss it away and get another. Actually, the proposed bill would address that issue, too. The law would extend guarantees on electronic goods, for example, obliging companies to offer repair services longer and to make spare parts so that third parties can do repairs more easily, say, for smartphones. At one smartphone repair shop in Barcelona, technician Tofik Baora says he'd welcome the law. He says phone makers are always releasing new models and making older ones obsolete through software updates. Each time, he says, it costs him money because the new phones often have new, unique types of screws holding them together. They do it to sell more parts, he says. If they didn't change, we could stock up on their screws. But no, we're forced to buy new ones with each new phone, plus the specialized tools that only work with the new screws. The right to repair clause would bring Spain in line with a Europe-wide directive to make it easier for people to get stuff fixed. But Spain's plan to ban fossil fuel ads would be the strictest ever in Europe. Last year in Belgium, the city of The Hague banned such ads on billboards. Amsterdam forbade them in metro stations. And calls for further prohibitions are growing. This week, the United Nations climate change chief, Alyssa Morguera, called for a global ban on fossil fuel advertising and the criminalization of misleading information. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Barcelona.
In that report for our Big Fix series, Jerry mentioned greenwashing.
Greenwashing is portraying a company as greener than it actually is.
That's Ben Franta. He's a professor of climate litigation at the University of Oxford, where he also runs a whole library of climate-related ads put up by fossil fuel companies. So the role this kind of advertising plays in the fate of our planet is something he has thought a lot about.
There are actually a lot of ads that promote fossil fuel brands, but in a sustainable way. So many of these ads will portray companies like ExxonMobil or Shell as sustainable companies, as clean energy companies, or as companies that are leading the way in the fight against climate change.
Right. I'm remembering BP calling themselves, or maybe entirely rebranding, as Beyond Petroleum. That's one that sticks in my head.
And that only lasted a few years. It was a huge PR move, but at the end of the day, the company didn't actually move away from fossil fuels.
Is there any indication that those kinds of ad campaigns change how people feel about using oil and gas or the industries that produce oil and gas?
There is evidence of it. Some of it comes from scientific research. So there have been some peer-reviewed papers published recently where consumers are shown these ads, and then they're asked, you know, how do you feel about this company? And in fact, even a single exposure to one of these ads has been shown to affect people's beliefs.
So what is the root of the problem here? I mean, these companies do invest some amount of money in other energy sources, solar, for example, and they also do, you know, invest some amount of money in carbon capture. So is there a truth in advertising problem here?
Well, there very well could be. The problem arises when we look at how much are these companies advertising themselves as sustainable companies and comparing that to what are they actually doing with their money. And if they're portraying themselves as shifting to clean energy when they're not actually doing that, then that could be considered misleading.
So Spain would be the first country to implement a national ban on fossil fuel advertising, but several cities around the world have already restricted these ads. There have also been bans on ads for just fossil fuel intensive industries. Have those made a difference? Is there any data on that yet?
It's a good question. I think some of these ad bans are fairly recent, so we don't know. But we have, by we, I mean researchers, we have a few examples of internal industry marketing documents where they assess how effective their own ad campaigns have been. And so in those, these companies are saying, look, you know, these ad campaigns are actually influencing people a lot.
Why focus on advertising, though, and not, you know, creating more alternatives to fossil fuels or making it more convenient for people to choose things that are less carbon intensive?
It's a really good question. They're both really important. You know, so while researchers are working on even better clean energy sources, even though clean energy is already expanding very rapidly and is very cheap in many cases compared to fossil fuels, there's also this issue of the incumbent industry. And of course, the fossil fuel industry is enormous. It has this incumbent advantage. It's been there for decades and longer, of course. And, you know, we see, historians have documented that these companies, they spent many decades disinforming the public about climate change. And these fossil fuel companies are holding on to their market share fiercely. And part of how they do that is through advertising and normalizing themselves, normalizing these companies to the public. And so it's very important, I think, to look at their ads and ask if they're actually aligned with what's happening in reality.
So if Spain enacts this ban on fossil fuel advertising, it would be the first country to do so. What will you be watching for to see if and how well it works?
I think I'd be really interested to see how it spreads. You know, this is a really interesting idea that more and more people are talking about. And of course, that's not perfect. It's not a silver bullet, but it's part of how we can move away from dangerous and harmful products.
Ben Franta is a professor of climate litigation at the University of Oxford.
The Indian city of Kolkata once had a thriving Jewish community. That was about a century ago. Today, the Jewish population there is very small. Synagogues that once held services are typically closed. But one synagogue in Kolkata opened for a special occasion. Reporter Sandeep Roy brought us a story late last year.
At 94, Flower Silliman was the oldest living graduate of the Jewish Girls' School of Kolkata. So it wasn't surprising that students of the school came together to sing a hymn at her memorial service at the Magan David Synagogue. Except the names of the girls singing this traditional Jewish hymn don't sound very Jewish at all.
Shemaisha,
Fatima,
Anasha.
Almost all the students at the Jewish girls' school in Kolkata are Muslim. The current estimate is that only around 20 Jews are left in Kolkata, mostly in their 70s or older, says Brian Auckland, the treasurer of the school.
So in any religious seminary, now it's mostly, burials. Okay, for the past 35 or 40 years, there's never been a marriage.
Even a funeral is difficult. Jewish tradition requires a minyan or 10 men to conduct a service. There's no minyan anymore, says Sidney Moses, vice president of the synagogue.
We don't have a rabbi, and the body is washed by the local people who we have engaged to wash the body. The prayers are read in English.
But there are still three beautifully maintained synagogues. The Magan David, where Silliman's memorial was held, a brick-red building with marble floors, chandeliers, and stained glass windows, is the largest, and possibly the only synagogue with a steeple, Flower Silliman told me several years ago.
The British people who built it decided to put a steeple because they thought it was a house of worship. We said, but synagogues don't have steeples. Why not?
The Jews of Kolkata wrote to the chief rabbi of Baghdad for advice. He said, okay, but...
it should be higher than any other place of worship for a radius of so much and so forth.
The Jews of Kolkata were called Baghdadi Jews. They came to India as traders from all over the Middle East during the 18th and 19th century. At one time, there were about 5,000 Jews living in Kolkata. The three synagogues were bustling.
When we were there, you couldn't even get a seat to sit in. You had to reserve your seat beforehand.
In Kolkata, synagogues like Magan David are right next to churches, mosques, and Hindu temples. Flower remembered trying to observe Yom Kippur while church bells rang, muezzins called the faithful to prayer in mosques, and drums beat in temples.
And I remember telling my mother, God must be getting deaf at so many people trying to get his attention at the same time.
Her mother scolded her.
And she said, don't talk like that. God is everybody's God, you know.
It's a lesson that Kolkata's little Jewish community took to heart. For example, they realized the people who understood their dietary rules best were Muslims. So the people known as Jewish cooks, meaning they cooked Jewish food for Jewish people, they weren't usually Jewish. In fact, Flower Silliman had a Muslim cook, and her daughter Yael says the cook was more Jewish than her mom. He would get upset if Flower didn't observe all the traditions.
He used to call my mommy Baba. Baba is not following the law. I'm going to tell her mother.
Now those Jewish cooks are gone, as are the Jews of Kolkata. A wave of emigration starting in the late 1940s took them elsewhere for better opportunities and larger Jewish communities, says Susan Lynn Iyer, who came to the memorial with her mother.
In London, in Israel, America, mainly England and Israel.
But the institutions they built still remain. Schools, synagogues, a Jewish bakery. Aya says she still comes to the synagogue on Jewish holidays with her mother, even though there's no service.
You just pray and go. There's no one here.
But that's not quite true. The synagogues have been left in the care of men like Abdul Khan, who hands out Jewish head coverings for us to wear inside. He says he is the third generation of his family working here.
Cleaning and everything, all the guests,
He's not the only one, says Sidney Moses. Generations of Muslim caretakers are the custodians of Kolkata's Jewish heritage.
It's their dedication. Their dedication, they say.
It's still a reminder that sometimes we have more in common with each other than we realize. That's why at her memorial, Flah Silliman's friend Aparna Guha bade her goodbye with a prayer of a different hue. For the world, this is Sandeep Roy in Kolkata.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Brass band playing, horse hooves clopping, spectators cheering, all part of Emmanuel Macron's arrival in London today.
The arrival of the President of France at the start of the state visit to the United Kingdom, where His Excellency and his wife will be met by the King and Queen.
Getting the British royal treatment from King Charles on a three-day state visit to the UK. It's the first time a French leader has been granted this since 2008. In 2016 and in the years that followed, there was Brexit, and relations between the two countries became famously testy. But today, leaders of both nations appeared keen to show that those days of political squabbling are behind them. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry joins us. So, Orla, given the years of frosty relations, how significant is Macron's visit to the United Kingdom?
Yeah, it's significant, isn't it? And in fact, Macron is the first European Union leader to be granted a state visit to the UK since Brexit. He even managed to secure a state visit with all its pomp and ceremony before President Trump does. President Trump is expected in September. A lot of what we saw today is symbolic and will be symbolic over the next few days. It's sort of showing the two countries back on the same side after the testy days, as you say, of Brexit. It wasn't that long ago. We were talking about bitter rows over fishing rights, Marco, whereas today was a very different relationship. I mean, you had Macron riding alongside King Charles in a carriage through Windsor Castle. He had this ceremonial guard of honour, a 41-gun salute, and then he gets to sit down at a state banquet later this evening. Today was very much the Macron and King Charles show. And in the next few days, we'll see a mixture of that, a mixture of pageantry and politics, I guess. But today was really about the pageantry.
So today, lots of nice optics. But what's going to be happening over the next couple of days on the political front?
Yes, and it did get political a little later this afternoon. President Macron addressed both houses of parliament. He began by talking about how democracies have come under attack on a daily basis. He called for a ceasefire in Gaza. He said European countries needed to end their excessive dependencies on both China and the US. And then he turned to the issue of Ukraine.
Every time Vladimir Putin's Russia advances in Ukraine, the threat moves closer to us all. We will never accept the theory that might is right. And I want to be clear. This is why, together with you, Mr. Prime Minister, we decided to launch last February this coalition of the willing you mentioned. And this coalition was just the signal that Europeans will never abandon Ukraine. Never.
And our understanding is over the next few days, there will be a summit on Thursday where the Ukrainian president is expected to join via video link. There'll be further discussions on defence and security between the UK and France. And then we're expecting a discussion on the issue of immigration and migrant crossings in the English Channel.
Right. And that is causing a lot of friction between both sides. Can we expect any announcement on that, Orla?
We can. We are to understand that there will be an announcement at some point tomorrow or Thursday about it. I mean, this is an issue that's been causing headaches for successive British prime ministers. In the last few years, we've seen UK leaders from both sides of the political spectrum promising to stop the boats, as they say, take back control of our borders, as we hear so much. And every year, the situation seems to be getting worse. This year, close to 20,000 people have arrived in Britain via small boats. And that's a 50% increase on the same period in 2024. It's a political weapon. It's the one that politicians of all sides bring up all the time. You had lawmaker Richard Tice even on radio a little earlier with a message for President Macron and Keir Starmer.
What the Prime Minister should be saying is what we're saying, which is, Monsieur President, either you stop the migrant boats or we'll stop your fishing boats. It's a very simple message. And all of a sudden, you'd have French fishermen clogging up the Champs-Élysées and this issue would possibly stop.
Richard Tice is with Nigel Farage's populist Reform Party. We understand that what British officials are hoping is that Macron will agree to a new kind of asylum seekers returns deal. And this deal, we understand, would see Britain returning to France, those who've crossed the Channel illegally, and in return for each person that's sent back, Britain would take in the same number of people with processed asylum claims. Now, whether this will cut mustard or not, we don't know. Italy, Spain and Greece have already said that they're not really happy about it. So it remains to be seen what happens there. I mean, presumably France and the French government will want to know financially what's in it for them if they do strike any deal.
We'll definitely be keeping our eyes on that. What about for President Macron himself, Orla? What does this visit mean for him?
It must be nice to be at the centre of attention and receiving lots of cheers and praise today, because back home, his approval rating is at an all-time low. A recent poll had him, just 22% of French voters said they trust him to lead the country. His influence over domestic politics in France, it certainly waned since his decision to call snap elections last summer. That resulted in his coalition losing control of parliament. And I was speaking to Andrew Smith earlier, who's an expert on modern French history at Queen Mary University of London. And he said, essentially, there's very little business being done in parliament right now in France.
Everyone seems to be waiting for 2027, a next presidential election. People seem to be waiting to see if the president will dissolve parliament again. At the moment, it feels like Emmanuel Macron has little play in domestic policy. And so I think it is important that the president is able to restate his prominence on the international scene.
And so having, you know, a whole state ceremony like this dedicated to him, it must be a breath of fresh air away from his political troubles back home.
The World's Europe correspondent, Orla Barry, thank you very much, as always.
You're welcome, Marco.
It might be hot where you are today. It is hot where we are. And so we leave you with a little news to cool you off. Painting roofs white is one tactic for deflecting heat from buildings, especially in urban areas. Researchers at universities in Singapore, China, Sweden, and the U.S. have taken that idea a step farther using AI.
They used artificial intelligence to formulate a new type of paint that can keep buildings cooler than normal paint does, anywhere between about 9 and 36 degrees Fahrenheit cooler under strong sun. The research was published in the journal Science. The Guardian reports the paint could also be used on cars, equipment, and pretty much anything that needs to keep cooler.
This news comes during the AI for Good conference in Geneva, Switzerland. We'll be hearing from that conference on tomorrow's show. Don't miss it.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org and find our original reporting also on YouTube. Be sure to subscribe to our new channel there. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you so much for listening.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Janae Elzy, Vicky and Michael Isip, Genji Kohan, Ashton Peary and Kate Wolf, and the Patchwork Collective. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.